is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We appreciate you taking time to join us for another edition of Midrats. And if you're with that esteemed cohort that's with us live, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that is where you'll find the chat room. The chat room is a great place to roll in with the usual suspects. And if you have some observations you'd like to share during the course of the show, or even if you have a question you would like for us to address to our guest over the course of the next hour, we'll be monitoring it during the show. We'll be glad to bring your good ideas into the conversation. Also, if you get to leave before the show is over, or you just want to catch up on prior Midrats, you can always take the shortcut and head on over to iTunes or whatever podcast aggregator you use. Go ahead and subscribe to Midrats, and you'll get the podcast as they are published, and you can listen at your own leisure. And for today's show, we're going to hit on a topic that if anybody's been paying attention, especially in the last 12 to 18 months, something that has always been here. And we'll touch on some of the history and some of the contemporary topics as the show goes forward. It's always been here, but it's finally breaking above the background noise. And it's not really since the last decade of the Cold War that ballistic missile defense, the threat of land-based cruise missiles, and especially conventional short, intermediate, medium-range capability in the ballistic missile arena has really gotten the attention outside of the very esoteric circles where these things are built, deployed, and discussed. And a few items have happened recently, I think, that have really brought it back into the arena of conversation outside of those normal circles. One of which that we'll talk about a bit has been the old Cold War era INF limitations have now gone to the wayside as we have withdrawn from the treaty. But it's just not those old things for the end of the Cold War. There have been developments, shipboard and land-based, not just the threat from missiles, but also the ability to counter them in a defensive way. And our guest today for the full hour to discuss these and other related topics is Dr. Thomas Carrico. Tom is a senior fellow with the International Security Program and the director of Missile Defense Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He also currently is an adjunct professor in the Strategic Studies Program in the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University and a fellow with the Institute for Politics and Strategy at Carnegie Mellon University. Tom, welcome to Midrats. Great to have you on board.
Gentlemen, good afternoon. Happy to be here.
And Tom, just as a way to set the table before we have the next hour unfolds in front of us, as I kind of mentioned in the intro, it's been, I don't think entertaining is the right word, but it's been good to see what, when you play this out, whether you war game it or if you just look at plain paper capability, the developments that have happened in the ballistic missile arena beyond what people conventionally think was the strategic ballistic missiles, that's just one sector of this whole capability, has really come to the front and broken above the background noise and just general open source reporting and people interested in national defense areas. And I just want to roll to you, what do you think are those top milestones that have happened in the last half decade or so that has brought the focus back into this area?
Well, that's a great question, a good way to kick it off really at the high level. Let me kind of start with a couple milestones that predate it that folks may have stuck in their mind more than in the past 5 years. You know, most folks you start talking about missile defense, they may think of SDIO, you know, Strategic Defense Initiative, and Reagan in 1983 and all that stuff. Or they may think about, you might say, the 1990s with Desert Storm and when Patriot air defenses were thrown into duty against some Iraqi Scuds in Israel and other places, and that kind of captured folks' imagination. After which Congress said, "Hey, we're not sure what this missile defense is, but we want some more of it." And then there was a kind of a big hullabaloo, a little bit of a polarized debate in Congress and otherwise in the 1990s about kind of whether we should stay in the ABM treaty, which goes back to 1972, or whether we should rather, get out of it so we can have at least some kind of limited missile defense against the likes of North Korea. And the big time there was, debating about whether North Korea or Iraq or whomever would have an ICBM. And the date was usually pegged to 2015. 2001, 2002 comes around, and the Bush administration withdraws from the ABM treaty. And actually, 15 years ago, in about a month, declared initial defensive capability for the system up in Alaska, the ground-based mid-course defense system. That's the big homeland missile defense program. That went live about 15 years ago. And so that kind of brings us up to, you might say, the modern era. The Obama administration came in and tweaked a little bit, but in other ways kind of, I think, really put into concrete the fact that missile defense was here to stay. Initiated the European phase adaptive approach with a lot of two Aegis Ashore sites in Europe and a bunch of missiles there. But we've really seen a lot of continuity, and that's something I really like to stress, is that over the past really 10 years, from 2009 onward, there's just been a whole lot of continuity whereby missile defense has become less of an exotic, boutique kind of thing. And we've first of all gotten pretty good at exo-atmospheric hit to kill on the one hand, but it's also been kind of matured and evolved and begun to be integrated into how the military and our national policymakers think about the overall spectrum. So, look, it's a lot's happened in the past decade. NATO's adopted it in a big way. Our allies are adopting it in a big way. And, it's a multi-billion dollar enterprise, not just for the U.S., but for a lot of our friends and allies around the world.
One of the things that when I was doing some research into this topic, one of the things that surprised me was in the 2010 Ballistic Missile Defense Review, I think it was, it talked about defense from limited ballistic missile attack. And I thought, well, that kind of makes sense because it's the thin line we have to walk. We can't announce we have a total defense against ballistic missiles because that would mean that Russia and China would be upset with us because that kind of destroys the nuclear balance argument. But to kind of discuss that a little bit, I mean, we're looking at a regional and homeland security, but the homeland security isn't total, but the regional, kind of discuss what the difference between those two things, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Yeah. Well, in the missile defense world, there's no the word limited is something of a four-letter word. And it was kind of a compromise back in 1999 when Congress passed legislation called the National Missile Defense Act, basically saying it's U.S. policy to have a limited ballistic missile defense. And then that had a certain meaning in the 1990s. It had a kind of a different meaning in the 2000s. But what it basically meant is frankly, as Bill Clinton said in a speech he gave in 2000, is look, it's kind of an insurance policy against, you might say, a small number of ICBMs from a rogue state, especially. And so you're right. Early on, especially, we weren't thinking so much. I mean, yes, in SDIO, but in the post-Cold War period, we were really thinking about the rogue states above all. And so you're right, however, to kind of flag that and say, to what extent does that still make sense? Some folks, in fact, Congress in 2016 went back and revised that. Now, that was 17 years later, right? It was probably in need of a lot can happen in 17 years. And so between 1999 and 2016, you kind of saw the ballistic missile threat get a little less limited. And so Congress went back and they revised it and they said, look, in light of the complex and growing ballistic missile threat, we need to do a little bit more on this. And so that was kind of the national policy statement that was changed. But then with the latest here is, of course, the post-Obama administration, the Trump administration. You mentioned the 2010 Ballistic Missile Defense Review. The 2019 Missile Defense Review drops the B, right? It drops that other adjective, and so opens the aperture as it needs to open to deal with non-ballistic missile types. And so in principle, at least, that includes, you might say, the couple of things that go under the phrase hypersonic, and it also includes cruise missiles and maybe some other things as well. But I like to say that there's just a whole spectrum of missile threats out there. It's just kind of where technology and strategy have kind of gone over the past several decades to kind of supplant various manned platforms or otherwise. So there's lots of things out there, and it makes sense to try to counter them with a variety of active and passive means.
As with most things in the military arena, there's always the eternal dance between capability, counter-capability, counter-counter-capability. Nothing's ever static and set in stone. And whether you're looking at the offensive use of ballistic missiles of a variety of ranges or defending from them, you have the sensors, you have the platforms that host or transport or launch them, and the weapons themselves. As in those three areas, sensors, platforms, and weapons, where is the technology advancing the fastest, and are different areas advancing at different rates in different countries that we've been able to see?
Are you talking about the sensors, platforms, and weapons on the threat offensive strike side, or the sensors, platforms, and weapons on the defensive side?
Really, it could be either side, but if you want to pick one or the other, feel free.
Well, I guess I think they are, of course, connected. I like to describe missile defense as the ultimate precision guidance challenge. And, you know, back in the 1970s, the idea that we could reach out and touch someone with any kind of precision might have seemed laughable, right? And yet you saw those videos from Desert Storm, and it kind of began to materialize there and in the Bosnian conflict, where, you know, precision guidance for the strike mission, it's a complex thing. I would add to sensors, platforms, and weapons, I would, of course, add the C2 complex and the battle management that puts it all together. That goes for both offense and defense. Likewise with missile defense, I mean, reaching out and touching a spot on the earth, you know, add an additional dimension there of time and motion, and you're reaching out to a particular point in space to hit something, traveling a ballistic trajectory. So sure, there's a host of sensor evolution that's gone on here. I'll just stick with that one for a minute. In terms of radars alone, right? So the radars that we would have used back in the 60s, and we, of course, had a missile defense deployment briefly up in North Dakota to protect our ICBM fields. It was very brief, but the kind of radars they had today or back then, and the kind we have today and the kind that are coming online, I mean, there's just dramatic differences in capabilities. Platforms, let me just sort of take a step back, maybe 15 years ago. That was kind of before UAVs were cool, and now we see various missiles, Hellfires, what have you, strapped under the wing of a Predator or something like that, and we don't even think twice about it. And so you kind of multiply that, add an order of magnitude to that, and you kind of have ballistic missiles hanging under manned aircraft, Russia's air-launched ballistic missiles. You got the specter of hypersonic scramjet cruise missiles, you know, launched from B-52 or some other platform. So the point being, these are kind of multi-domain, as the folks say, and so you can launch them from all manner of domains and all manner of platforms, and then of course there's all manner of technologies that go into the effectors themselves, not merely propulsion and what maneuvers them, of course also their guidance. And especially the terminal guidance. So whole lots of interesting things going on across the board there.
Yeah, I want to kind of go back to, we've got a bifurcated system here in the sense that we've got a homeland security system, and you're talking about Fort Greely up in Alaska with its systems up there, and also I guess there's a few of those down at Vandenberg, and I assume that some of the ships we have, the ballistic missile defense ships we have, are capable of some homeland security defense, but we also have the regional defense against missiles of various types, and somewhere it says that the purpose of this is to make sure that we have freedom of military action in the areas where we need to operate. Can you kind of discuss that a little bit?
That's first of all, thank you for drawing attention to that. Among other things, that was mentioned in the 2010 Ballistic Missile Defense Review, the Obama administration's missile defense review, and I think there's similar verbiage in the 2019 version. But I'm glad you mentioned that because it really ties into what I talked about in terms of, you might say, the maturing of missile defense from something that's a boutique capability to something that's more integrated into our overall military thinking and posture. Because at the end of the day, it's not just about that insurance policy against North Korea. It's also about being able to protect our forces and not having, you know, whether it's a ballistic or an anti-ship cruise missile, you know, push us back from regions we'd like to sail around or operate from, air bases, ships, that sort of thing. And so the operational side of this, and that usually goes under the phrase regional, that's tremendously important. And I give credit to the Obama administration for kind of doubling down on the regional side of this. We may actually have to double down on the quote-unquote regional side again, but I like to say that North America is a region too. And once you kind of move away from strictly, you know, ICBM, intercontinental, highly predictable ballistic missile threats, and you move to these other things, and you begin to look more at boost glide or just straight cruise missile threats, including to the homeland, well, then, you know, the defense of the American homeland, the defense of the American capital and all this other stuff, it looks a lot more like what's frequently called a regional missile threat. And so, you know, if you ask the Israelis, for instance, whether they're more interested in regional or ballistic missile defense, or the Japanese, if they're more interested in regional or ballistic missile defense, they might look at you a little strange. And I think we're kind of getting a little bit closer to that situation ourselves in terms of how the threat has evolved. One man's national missile defense is another man's theater missile defense, depending on what the threat is. So some of this is kind of anachronisms and artifacts of the ABM treaty era that I don't really want to, you know, get into unless somebody wants to. But the fact that the regional and the you might say quote unquote tactical air and missile defense has evolved and advanced the way it is, I think that's tremendously important. And I think you actually are seeing new aspects of this, new strides underway just over the past couple of years. Put aside the rogue state ballistic missile for a minute and look at what the U.S. Army is doing in terms of maneuver short-range air defense. You know, back in 2006 when we were completely focused on CT, counterterrorism, and we were given to understand that we could take air superiority for granted for the foreseeable future. First the Bush administration, then the Obama administration divested of the short range air defense problem. You know, we're going to have to probably worry about fixed and rotary wing aircraft quite so much. And now here we are in the post Ukraine and post Crimea period when history has returned. And you see the U.S. Army scrambling to reconstitute those capabilities so that there's not a gap. There's not a gap in terms of everything from mud to space in terms of how the adversary can attack you. So once you kind of come to grips with the fact that we don't have air superiority anymore, it's not a birthright, then you're going to have to contend with a lot of different ways to get after this spectrum of threats, again, both active and passive.
You know, when you speak of return to history, and you were right, in a lot of areas, because of our extended counterinsurgency operations that are still ongoing, and in Western Asia, we did kind of accept some risk and hedge a bit in some areas. And thinking about the threat for ballistic missiles was one of them. And you can almost, in the modern era, you have the initial, you know, the scud hunt of, and the, you know, the Iraqis got lucky in the last couple of days with their relatively unguided scud. And then we had another little tap on the shoulder from capability during, in 2008, during the Georgian conflict between Russia and a few of the Georgian separatists, where the Russians used, depending upon your sources, a dozen or more, and I still like the old NATO terms, the SSN-21s and everybody's boogeyman, the SSN-22 Stone or the Iskander missile, whatever you want to call it, short-range ballistic missiles in the conventional mode. And you saw a change in capability and accuracy, but 2008 was 11 years ago. Time and technology moved forward. What other jump has taken place for the threat you have to defend from, coming from that 2008 data point that some people might be familiar with?
Well, first of all, let me comment on the two examples that you gave. You picked out, if I'm not mistaken, a pretty interesting sea-launched anti-ship missile, number one. And second, you picked out the Iskander, which neither one of those is strictly ballistic. You know, the Iskander is, sometimes it's called aeroballistic, whatever. But the point being, in both of those examples kind of demonstrate another thing I like to foot stomp, and that is that the threat has gone lower. The threat has gone less exo-atmospheric, you know, highly predictable parabolic ballistic paths, and more endo-atmospheric maneuvering aerodynamic kind of flight. And both of those, yes, they're older systems, but in many respects they kind of point to the newer problems. And the newer technologies. In the first instance, I mean, look at what hard to keep track. We do keep track of these things on our website, Missile Threat, for the CSIS Missile Defense Program. But I think Mr. Kim is up to something like seven of the Iskander lookalikes over the past couple of months, as he's doing his darndest to get us to, I don't know, pay attention to him or something. But why is that important? Well, because, you know, our THAAD and other missile defenses, to some extent, have been tailored to that predictable and more lofted ballistic trajectory. And so with North Korea, with Russia and all these other folks, the caliber with Russia, I mean, they're flying low. They're hugging, you know, in one way or another, they're taking advantage of the curvature of the Earth. And that complicates the missile defense job. Doesn't make it impossible by any means. But what it means is you need different sensors to see these things sooner, and you need to track them consistently, birth to death, to be able to kill them. If you can track them, you know, you can get after them. It's a complex air defense job, right? But when you have a single unitary object flying along, whether it be a manned aircraft or whether it be one of these things, they're not the same thing. But it's fundamentally a tracking problem to get after it. So that of course the set of things that fall under the name hypersonic, primarily scramjet cruise missiles on the one hand, may go faster than Mach 5, and then likewise the hypersonic boost glide vehicles that start off ballistic and then come back down and kind of bounce and hop along the atmosphere, that may well go a lot faster than Mach 5. So those are the primary things, but I would just add one more thing to that, and I'm glad you pointed to, first of all, the Georgian conflict, but also the Ukraine conflict, is it's not about any one bright, shiny object or silver bullet. The real challenge here is the imaginative and wicked combination of these threats, you know, in sequence, simultaneously, or what have you. You know, think about the Aegis ships and think about, you know, there's X number of objects they can track, and they're looking in this direction or they're looking in that direction at any one given time. Well, it's the combination, it's kind of the combined arms problem of everything from UAVs to anti-ship cruise missiles to ballistic and you know, hypersonic things, that is an extraordinarily complex air defense challenge, whether you're a ship moving around on the ocean or whether you're an airbase or what have you. So the other, it's not quite, it's not technology, right? It's a more of the operational concept kind of thing, is the mixing and matching of these things. And you, this isn't hypothetical. This is not an academic problem. Actually, the Houthis are doing this on a regular basis in the Yemen Missile War, which has been going on since 2015. They're creating structured attacks with UAVs and missiles together. Now, they're getting some help, of course, from their friends, but that's the other aspect that kind of complements the technology and makes the whole thing a bit more challenging.
Eagle One, you there?
Yeah, the minute you started talking about the integrated attack systems, I started thinking about Red Storm Rising and the scene in there where the bad guys whammied the U.S. fleet by making them expend all their anti-aircraft and missile capability, and then hit them with a second wave. And I thought, well, yeah, that's, you know, we've fought that, at least in the surface Navy, that has been an issue for some time, that we've always got to be aware of these kamikaze type attacks. Are you still with me?
Yep, and, yep, I'm here.
Okay. Hezbollah and their attacks on the Israeli ships with the C-802 or 803 or whatever, the 801 missiles, you talk about the Houthis and their attacks, not just on the Saudis and their other enemies, but they also went after a couple of U.S. ships,
yep,
using missiles. And we've got
missile very similar to the one used against the Israelis in 2006.
And we also what we used to call the silkworms in the Gulf problem. You know, the reaction time for responding to a shore-based attack has always been an issue. I think Aegis has gone a long way to be an answer for the U.S. Navy, and we've also moved, this is where I'm going with this, we've also moved Aegis ashore in Romania, I guess, and Poland, and Japan certainly got that. What other steps? I mean, I know the Israelis have got like their layers defenses from I guess they use Patriot and Iron Dome and Arrow and David Sling. I mean, are we looking at the necessity for having layered defenses like that in response to these integrated threats?
So you just put a lot on the table. All of it.
Thank you.
Good. lots of different directions I could go there. Let me just sort of walk through those things. First of all, thank you for calling attention to the, I think it was 2006 attack by Hezbollah against the Israeli ship. And they used one of those C-801 or C-802, I forget which one, and they hit the ship, right? Now flash forward 10 years to October 2016, and what do you see on YouTube? You see a video of I think it was an Emirati ship that was hit by some kind of missile or maybe shelled. And then about a week later, one of those same anti-ship cruise missiles is thrown, turns out to be several of them, thrown against the USS Mason, sailing along near Yemen, near the Red Sea. Now, the USS Mason is an Aegis ship, and thankfully it was there and capable of defending itself against those things, using both, according to public reports in USNI, you can read the account there, using both kinetic and non-kinetic means. I mean, that is an air defense problem, and I like to point out that what didn't happen is you didn't see the YouTube video of American sailors from the Mason in the way that you saw it with that Emirati ship. The United States wasn't in a situation where we were going to have to go get involved in a land war in Yemen, because if USS Mason had been successfully attacked, you know, you can just imagine the kind of reaction that the United States might have had. So instead, we threw some Tomahawks at them and hit the launchers in the next couple days. And so there, first of all, you see a very non-theoretical, very real example of how active missile defenses contribute to strategic flexibility in that Mason attack. Now connect that, move from the destroyer off the coast of Yemen to the sites that you talk about in Romania and Poland. These are the Aegis Ashore sites, and these were announced as part of the European phase adaptive approach in 2010 by the Obama administration. And they've, Romania's online. In fact, it just got a little bit of an upgrade. Got a little work done, and Poland is coming online. Poland is being built and should be up here in a couple years. And having said that, those sites really are tailored to, there's that phrase again, the limited ballistic missile threat. They're not built for integrated air and missile defense. They are strictly about that exo-atmospheric, highly lofted threat coming from, you might say, the Middle East, the vicinity of Iran in one way or another. And that's fine, but NATO endorsed that back in 2010. In fact, the strategic concept that NATO put out in 2010 made missile defense a core alliance mission, which is a sea change from where the alliance was in 2000. When the United States was saying, hey, we might want to do national missile defense. Our NATO allies weren't too keen on that because they were worried about decoupling. 10 years later, NATO makes it a core alliance mission, and then here we are today, by 2015 and such, we've got these facilities there. But you exactly point to the, what's not there, and that's the air defense challenge. Well, last summer in Brussels, I think it was June or July, one of these summits, all 29 heads of state said, we need to get after the integrated air and missile defense challenge. And they kind of pointed out the challenge of the Russian cruise missiles and the INF violating and things like that. But so you might say we're getting better at kind of admitting that we have not merely a Russia problem, but a Russia missile problem. And that it's a mix of things, not just ballistics, but other things. We're going to have to, go a long way to contend with that. It's possible that adapting those two sites may have a role there, but it also might be something that's a little bit more distributed rather than just two locations to kind of get after it. What is, after all, a very challenging, cruise missile threat. So you've seen it with the Houthis, but to get after it from the big guys, be it China or Russia, that's going to require a much bigger lift.
I think one of the bigger lifts when you really start looking at this is math is hard. Math is also pretty unforgiving because for those of us of a certain age who grew up in the Cold War, there was the old cliche that we're only 30 minutes from complete annihilation. And when you look at whether what Israel is looking at or what we're looking at in our Japanese allies, and even our Australians, to go look at it, the math of the short, intermediate, medium-range ballistic missile threat, conventional or otherwise, if there is any type of conflict in the Western Pacific, the time from warning to impact is incredibly small and short. When you look at what the Chinese have built from an offensive perspective with that capability in the Western Pacific, what are some of the tools that we already have in place that have shown to be the most valuable to modify to address that? And are there certain shortfalls from the sensor standpoint and the early warning standpoint that we need to redouble our efforts on if we really are going to address that concern?
Lots of goodness there as well. A lot of stuff put on the table. Let me kind of start working through that. You kind of saw a very small piece of this when in Desert Storm there was that one ballistic missile that hit a U.S. barracks in Saudi Arabia and killed so many service members. It was the biggest casualty, single largest number of casualties in the conflict. Now multiply that by a couple of orders of magnitude to our fixed and semi-fixed targets, let's just say in Japan or South Korea, what have you, Guam, right? And when you are contending not with Iraq or a rogue state, but when you're contending with a near peer in one way or another, everybody knows where Guam is. everybody knows where Kadena is and so on. And so their ability to structure an attack with a high time compression, you're right to draw attention to that. It seems insurmountable. And that, I think, is why over the past couple of years, and really this goes back to the late Obama administration, when you saw somebody like Bob Work, beginning to talk about the need to adapt Army air and missile defense here. But let's just for our current discussion, deal with the post-national defense strategy. So the national defense strategy says, okay, we got to focus on the near peer. And if you kind of skip to the end of that 10 pages or however many pages it is, on the last page or so, it really begins to talk about basing. And so this has kind of been something talked about for years. But if you have your proverbial iron mountains where you make really good and juicy targets for the other guy, don't worry, they'll find a way to target it really effectively. And so the real kind of this is really gets into passive defense in one way or another, is how do you have a forward presence while not creating such amazingly sweet and big fat juicy targets for the other guy that they will be taken out in the first 5 minutes. And so, not relying so much on certain air bases and things like that are a piece of it. And I would point to what I think are really the locus of the most important thinking going on right now, and that's the several service concepts. And just do a quick word search. For the Navy, you got distributed maritime operations. I like to point to one of the essays that underneath that a couple years back called Distributed Lethality, right? The idea of complicating the surveillance and targeting job for the bad guys. For the Navy, putting strike assets on everything that floats, but also moving away from just having a small number of really lucrative targets. And then skip to the Army in the multi-domain battle, right? They're emphasizing maneuver. Move things around. Move rapidly so that you can't be easily targeted by a Russia or China. And then point to the new Commandant's planning guidance for the Marines that was just put out that's gotten all these accolades. Do a quick word search on dispersal and distribution in that document. It's all over the place. And so distribution and dispersal you see throughout these three documents, and that seems to me the foundation of how to that really deserves a little bit more explicit attention. It's getting the attention, but a little bit more explicit recognition, I guess, for how to get after that big challenge. Because they got lots and lots of missiles, as you say. So the first step in the beginning of wisdom here is don't be an easy target, and then that also goes to how do we posture our offensive missile forces, and that's kind of more of an INF post INF issue as well.
Yeah, I'm old enough to remember when I think I used to build a model kit of I think it was a Minuteman missile in a train car. they were gonna shuttle these things all around the country.
Well, and, that was probably a peacekeeper. That was probably
peacekeeper. Exactly. And I think we also knew that as spies like us, I think the movie was the Russians had big ballistic missile launchers that were very mobile, that they were moving around their country all the time like pieces on a chessboard, which. That's I guess nothing is really new in the world, but it is kind of funny that it goes back. But let's talk about this integrated missile and or air and missile defense systems that they're discussed in a piece you did in your missile defeat review article. But you wrote that before the 2019 Missile Defense Review came out from the DOD. What should we be doing? What is in the 2019 Missile Review, and are you happy with what's in there?
Mm. So you're referencing a report that we put out, multi-authored, multi-chapter report. I wrote a couple chapters in it that we released. I think it was in January or March of 2017. And the idea was, hey, Congress last year in 2016 said, go hither and do a missile defense review to the incoming administration. And so we got you know, some smart people to contribute chapters on what that ought to look like. So we put that out in 2017. Hopefully the folks that did it read it. I think they did. And 2 years later, of course, the administration put out its own review. I think that we've already kind of hit on some of the big ways in which the MDR adopted, you might say, that more integrated air and missile defense approach in terms of you drop the B, you drop the ballistic. That was as much as anything at the behest of Congress, but hey, they get credit for dropping it. And so in terms, I would say, at least of describing the problem of, and this all begins with a threat, in terms of recognizing the character of the threat, I think the 2019 Missile Defense Review gets a lot right. It's not just about ballistics, it's cruise, it's hypersonic, it's all this stuff. Probably could have done a little bit more about the aerial threat, air defense issues. You didn't see a whole lot about that in the Missile Defense Review, but I think that probably deserves more attention. And again, back to Aegis. Aegis is a layered defense system against both air and missile threats. So there's goodness there, but in terms of programmatics, I've written on this two or three times since the review came out. In terms of programmatics, there's more continuity than discontinuity between, you might say, the Trump missile defense policy and the Obama or pre-national defense strategy programs, which continuity is sometimes a very good thing as opposed to vacillating wildly. But when your problem set has changed from the rogue state ballistic missile threat to great power competition, you're going to need more than incremental change. And so overall, we've seen some good incremental changes and some good kind of pointing in the right direction. Probably still going to be incumbent upon the 21 budget, the 2021 budget proposal, to make a little bit more radical change. I think we'll see some of that on the sensor side and on you might say more innovative operational deployments of these things. So both on the defense side and on the offense side, I'm hopeful that the next the budget cycle will begin to tackle these in ways that the 20 budget didn't.
Yeah, I'm glad that you finally mentioned Aegis. With so much Navy on the show today, I know our friends in the Aegis Mafia would be mad at us if we didn't talk a little bit about Aegis as well. I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit more, because with some people who aren't familiar about the different builds and the modernizing capability and the iterative building on what was, they think of Aegis, they go, Aegis has been around since the 1970s, but it really is, with each new build, almost a different capability from what came before, a nice iterative development. But it has some advantages over other capabilities in defense. Kind of flesh out a little bit, you know, Aegis at sea or in Aegis ashore itself, why that has been a solution here and going forward for a lot of the challenges.
Mm. Well, I think it comes down to the fundamentals and the Aegis philosophy, frankly. There was so much that Admiral Meyer envisioned way back when Aegis was still young, that you were frankly just getting around to implementing. Think about NIFCA in terms of or engage on remote, launch on remote, these kinds of things, tying different Aegis ships together so that one ship can fire off another ship's track, right? Those are the kind of things that Wayne Meyer saw and envisioned and began working to a long time ago, and we're still kind of getting there in terms of some of these threats. But I think it kind of comes down to other characteristics as well. And I'm thinking especially things like adaptability and modularity and the principle of layered defense, air and missile defense, and some effectors that reach out further and some effectors that are more close in. I mean, these are, I would say, buzzwords, sometimes cliches in other aspects of the Pentagon, but they have been and are very real, of course, to the Aegis combat system and to Aegis BMD. And now, with Baseline 9, to integrate air and missile defense so that these ships can kind of defend against, do both at the same time, both air and ballistic threats. So I like to really kind of highlight the characteristics of the Aegis combat system as a template, a model to the rest of the joint force. The Patriot system is both an air and ballistic missile defense thing, but we've got other things like THAAD that are just for ballistics, and we've got ground-based mid-course defense up in Alaska just for ballistics. And so given how the threat has evolved, I'm not kind of picking a particular widget or anything, or launching system or anything like that, or missile. It's the characteristics of the combat system that are sufficiently flexible and have that baseline evolution over time. Those characteristics are going to be more important over time. And I would say, frankly, they were one of the inspirations for how, when the Missile Defense Agency got stood up and these other things got stood up, what was then called sort of spiral development of these systems. I mean, there have been, not called baselines, but there have been, updates to all these different programs through the Missile Defense Agency over the years. So I think Aegis is a tremendous model for the Joint Force, for our international friends as well. And you're seeing people like Japan, for instance, who are buying two Aegis Ashore sites for themselves. I think if the Japanese are as focused on the big threat, on the China threat, as they are on the little threat, the North Korea threat, their Aegis Ashore sites are probably going to look a little different than the site in Romania, for instance. And it may take a little while, but I think it would probably make a lot of sense for the Japanese sites to really be focused on various air threats, think Chinese cruise missiles, as much as on other things. So that's where the threat is, and the characteristics of Aegis are such that I think we'll be very well positioned to deal with it. There's other challenges, I think Guam and that kind of stuff, where our Aegis assets in the Pacific are stretched a little thin, but we'll find a way to get after it.
Well, that does lead me to a question that involves looking at what other services are doing. I mean, you mentioned THAAD, you mentioned Patriot. Those are Army systems, essentially. But the Army has an obligation for theater air defense where their forces are occupied. They can't sit near the ocean and wait for the Navy to handle it all. I remember the days when, in fact, the Army had the Nike Hercules and Nike Ajax ballistic missile interceptors or whatever they were supposed to do. I'm not quite sure how that worked out, but what is the Army doing to cover these problems of these short range or longer range missiles that could be aimed at their concentrations of forces?
Well, we got to it a little bit backwards, but this is kind of the big can of worms that I think is probably going to define the Navy's relation to missile defense in the next couple of years as much as anything. And I was interested in how you framed it there. You know, the Army's out there sitting on dirt, so shouldn't they be defending said dirt? But of course, it's very much a joint problem. And it's those air bases aren't just occupied by soldiers, but of course, the U.S. Air Force has all kinds of assets on forward deployed bases. It is very much a joint forward presence. And the question is, who has the joint responsibility to defend those things against air and missile attack? And you're right, the U.S. Army has had an outsized piece to that. Not the only piece. And a big piece of that, for instance, is the Aegis ships that are floating out there. The U.S. Army has THAAD in South Korea, THAAD in Guam, and there's Patriots kind of all over the place. But Aegis ships have a role here too, and I think it was Admiral Richardson who kind of talks about the tyranny of geography in the Pacific with respect to this mission. A part of the tyranny of geography is that the defended area is often behind your defender. And so you can have, you might say, especially terminal defenses like Patriot or something like that. But the amount of defended area is going to go up, is going to go way up when you're able to shoot at it earlier. And so that's one of the reasons why Aegis ships, let's just say somewhere between North Korea and Japan, or somewhere between North Korea and Guam. That's why they've been tapped to support this role. Not the only role, but they have been tapped for this role and for other places as well. It's a very capable system. Aegis is very much a multi-mission asset, but for ballistic missile defense as well. The Navy signed on to that mission, I think, you know, early 2000s. And the Missile Defense Agency's money has really helped a lot in terms of driving baseline development, Spy 6 for the Flight 3s and all this kind of stuff. And so that's really advanced the Aegis fleet in a big way. And so the controversy right now is going to be, you know, does the Navy get out of the ballistic missile defense mission for the defense of DIRT, as Admiral Richardson, as CNO, began to allude, or are they going to have a role here for the defense, not merely the fleet, but also of and sea control, but also of DIRT? And I think it's probably going to be a mix. And the strong signals from both the Missile Defense Review and from the Hill over the years, to a little bit to the consternation of some Navy folk, is no, we want you to have a role in this joint mission after all. So that's going to be something that's continued to hash out over the next couple of years.
Yeah, I found that curious too, and it's one of those things you have to be careful what you do. It's like a service finds itself doing a certain capability, and it kind of scratch your head. It's like in most of the nations of the world, open ocean ASW is in the air, is done by naval units, but the British, the Royal Air Force does it. You just don't know what direction it's going to change. So it would be interesting to see whether we can hand that off at one point. And part of it may be like over in the chat room, a longtime listener, Paul Withington, made the comment that you got to wonder sometimes, you know, which Army guys are at the table. Experience with his son is, and most people know this, those that went air defense artillery from West Point didn't have much of a choice. It wasn't, you know, the premier career path. So how do they, and you hate to say that, but that's something that can't be ignored. That, you know, maybe the Army doesn't want to have it, or doesn't want the Navy not to have a role in it, simply so they don't have to give a little extra boost to their air defense artillery guys. But, you know, look at that Aegis ashore, whether it's Navy, it's Army, or somebody wants to do that type of joint resolution, is Japan, as you mentioned, is going to get a couple of Aegis ashore that they're going to run. And, of course, we have a history with Aegis, with the Japanese Navy, to go back there. But before the latest iteration, you really saw a few years ago, probably in conjunction with everybody was focused on Ukraine, the short range and intermediate range ballistic missiles that have been moved into the Kaliningrad Oblast, former East Prussia, and the threat from Russia. And yes, you're going to have the facilities we talked about before in European NATO, and NATO has said some nice things at some nice conferences. But when we look at our NATO allies, have they invested any to a significant degree in building their own ballistic missile or missile defense systems, or has their resolution been the USA will do it? How are our European NATO allies looking at the challenge and investing against it?
So you kind of put two big things on the table there. One, yeah, on the NATO side, and the first part was back to Aegis ashore, and I want to come back to that. Let me answer the bit about NATO, and that is that, look, it's true that the United States has put the most dollars and effort into ballistic missile defense anyway for NATO, and the two Aegis ashore sites are the center of that. look, our allies, not all of them have the resources and certainly not the technology around BMD. And so there's other things that can be done there, I think, especially on the sensor side. And frankly, you know, making sure that we stitch together every sensor that we can in NATO for awareness, especially of aerial threats. Can NATO do a lot more? Absolutely. I don't think ballistic missile defense is necessarily the or longer range ballistic missile defense is necessarily the area that we need every other of the 28 members to be going after. But there's probably a whole lot that there are things that can be done in terms of stitching things together for air defense. Now Turkey going in the other direction on S-400 versus Patriot or something like Patriot doesn't help. Because we can't connect to them, and that's a bigger piece of territory and bigger periphery that we can't therefore monitor. So, you know, that complicates the problem. But let me go back to the first part of what you said, because I think for a Navy audience especially, this is the central question, and that is you talked about ease of shore. I kind of alluded to this when I was suggesting that you know, Aegis ashore, let's just say in Guam or something like that, may make a whole lot of sense for the defense of Guam. But because the defended area is so frequently behind what you're trying to defend, it is going to have a little bit less of a reach than a ship that's, you might say, between the threat and Guam. Having said that, the kind of strains on the Navy, on the Aegis fleet in particular, are such that it could make a whole lot of sense. And I would add Pearl Harbor to that as well. And I think it was you, Mark, who talked about kamikaze attacks. Well, kamikaze attacks was one of the inspirations for the Aegis combat system, you know, coming out of World War II to kind of develop something that was capable of dealing with all these kind of wicked aerial threats. And so the question then becomes is who's going to pay for it? You know, Admiral Richardson was out there talking about Aegis ashore as one way to alleviate the alleged strain on the Aegis ships in terms of the tethers and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, I think the Navy has frequently been quite happy for that bill to be paid by somebody else. And when you kind of cut through it, a lot of this comes down to budgets. A lot of the talk about, well, we want the Army to do that for the defense of dirt. Well, okay, but what if the Aegis combat system in Guam is the right system to do it, right? And if so, and you want the Army to handle it, well, then that means you're going to have to let soldiers train on the Aegis combat system. And so that means you're going to have to give up some billets for sailors, perhaps, to let in some soldiers train on them. So this is, you know, these are the kind of questions that when you get right down to it, inter-service rivalry doesn't always make for the best way to kind of come at this problem. And really looking at it from a national level is necessary to figure out what's the right solution for the defense of, say, Guam or what have you, and then what's the division of labor and the roles and missions for how to get after it. That's critical. What you saw with the Missile Defense Review is kind of an insistence that, yes, all 60 Aegis ships will eventually, they said within 10 years, but eventually get the ballistic missile defense capability. Now, if you're the Navy, that's a good thing because that's going to drive something that Admiral Boxall has warned about, you know, driving down the proliferation of different baselines that are out there, so every ship's a little bit different. The more commonality we have out there for the Navy, all the best. But I think bottom line here, the Navy is going to have a role in the missile defense and ballistic missile defense mission for as long as missile threats exist. And they're probably going to have a role for the defense not only of themselves, but also of other critical assets as well. And so that means as much as we want to have these exquisite, wonderful multi-mission ships doing all the things they're capable of, there's going to be some need for the Navy, whether ashore or at sea, to continue to remain as or tethered to the defense of other things as well.
Well, at the risk of stealing some more time from you this afternoon, I'm going to throw out one question. But first, I want to thank you for coming on today. It's been fascinating, and we probably ought to have you back again so we can ask another 300 questions and take another 5 or 6 or 7 weeks to do this.
This is all fun.
um, what NORAD? I'm going to talk about NORAD for a minute. I mean, just for a second. What do they do now? I mean, they're ballistic missile conscious. I know that, and when they used to deal with waves of bombers coming over the North Pole. But what should their role be in these cruise missile hypersonic world that we're rolling into?
Well, in terms of missile defense, you mean?
Yeah,
I guess
missile air defense. I mean, aren't they supposed to do all that stuff? Don't they? I mean,
right.
I can't remember
right.
exactly
North,
what
North
they
American,
do.
North American air defense. So, a piece of this is going to be, you know, who is in charge and how do you go about acquiring the capability for the defense of the U.S. homeland, or more precisely, the defense of certain critical assets in the U.S. homeland against, let's just say, cruise missiles or hypersonic delivery systems of various kinds. It may well be a fool's errand to have, you know, comprehensive air defense of every acre of the United States, but for certain very critical assets, that's where we're going to need robust air defense. And whether it's with elevated sensors on a tether or a dirigible or something, you're going to have to see it. This is back to the Aegis philosophy, detect, control, engage. You're going to have to detect it and really track it. And then you're going to have somebody, maybe it's NORAD or somebody in the NORAD facility, or maybe it's somebody more localized, kind of decentralized command and control, certainly for let's just say the D.C. area or something like that. Detect, control, and then you're going to have assets in place around those things, be they subpens or command and control or what have you. So I'm not sure you do everything out of NORAD. I'm not sure what the solution is. They're pretty tied in, of course, to GMD right now. So that kind of is a piece of how you could come after this problem. But the character of these air threats being kind of everywhere is such that you may need to have redundant command and control too. So I'm not sure whether in the same way you can't do everything out of Alaska for missile defense, I'm not sure you do everything out of NORAD, but they may have a role too.
And on that note, Tom, it has been a great hour. Really appreciate you taking time today to come join us. You mentioned early on in the show something I want to point out all the listeners to. If you'd like to dig a little deeper into the topic, CSIS has a dedicated webpage, missilethreat.csis.org, that I would encourage everybody to go bounce around in a little bit. But if people wanted to read up and keep track of you, Tom, what are the best ways they can do that?
Just take a look at the Missile Threat website, or just Google my name for CSIS, and you'll find kind of a link to the publications that myself and my team for the Missile Defense Project put out. We try to talk on everything, kind of budget, program, policy, a little bit of everything related to this stuff.
Perfect. And we'll be in touch, and I look forward to seeing what you have come down the road, Tom. Thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Well, appreciate the opportunity to be on.
And one little, I guess, a programming note I wanted to say before the end of the show. To my illustrious co-host, earlier this year, you were gone for a while and came back, but you want to give the listeners a heads up on what's up next?
Yeah, I'm attempting part of the Appalachian Trail again. I'm turned into a section hiker, so I'm trying to do a long section. I don't know exactly how long, and that'll depend on weather and how well my legs hold up, but I'll be out for a while, I hope.
Well, we'll be in touch at least on the side, and we'll see if we can scare up Claude and Hipple to come in and keep your seat warm for you. But we wish you the best, Eagle One, and we'll see you on the other end.
Great. Thank you very much. And again, Tom, thank you for coming on today. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
And everybody else, appreciate you taking time today for joining us for another edition of Midrats. Until next time, hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Molly wrote a neat reply to Iris Patio, saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me and so on. best friend and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know.
Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, let us swear.
It's a long, long way to Tipperary.